Hey, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I rise to introduce my colleagues at council table, Douglas Meehl, Emily Shanahan from the Ropes and Gray firm in Boston, and also with us at council table is Thomas Lorero, an in-house counsel at Interesis Networks. With the court's permission, Mr. Meehl is going to present an argument on behalf of the appellant today.
And welcome to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Meehl, the way this clock works, you have a total of 20 minutes for when I start the clock. We will start counting down in front of you. The light will be green until you get to the time you reserve 2 minutes, and then it will be yellow. You can continue speaking, but you'll be using up the 2 minutes you reserved.
I think I reserved 4, actually.
You did.
And I plan to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal and 16 for my argument in chief.
Fortunately for you, I didn't set the clock.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Douglas Meehl on behalf of the appellants. In our briefs, Your Honors, we made basically 4 arguments as to why we believe the judgment of the trial court in this matter should be reversed. What I was planning to do today in my argument in chief is address a couple of the main issues that emerged from the briefs in regard to each of those 4 arguments. Our first argument on appeal, and we believe each of these 4 arguments is an independent, at least sufficient basis to reverse the judgment below. Our first argument on appeal is the argument that I think of as the contract language argument. As the court is aware from the briefs, this case involves a contractual provision pursuant to which my client, Interesis, then known as Cabletron, had the choice, one, to replace certain incentive stock options that a Cabletron subsidiary known as GNTS had issued a year or so earlier with equivalent Cabletron incentive stock options. That was choice number one. Or choice number two under this contractual provision, which the parties have referred to in the briefs and before the trial court as the substitution provision, choice number two was instead to pay the holders of these GNTS stock options, $4.62 million, the aggregate of all of the stock options. What happened in the case under that contractual provision is that my client, Cabletron, elected door number one, choice number one, and elected to replace the original GNTS options with equivalent Cabletron stock options. And that choice is what precipitated the lawsuit. The trial court ruled that under Clause 1 of the substitution provision, when Cabletron came to issue the replacement stock options, Cabletron was required to structure the options so that the value of the replacement options matched the value that the original GNTS stock options had as of the date of the grant of those original GNTS stock options a year earlier. What Cabletron had done was structure the options so that the value matched the value that the value of the replacement options matched the value that the original GNTS options had as of the date of their replacement. Trial court ruled that that was not what the contract required, and on that basis ruled that Cabletron, my client, had breached the substitution provision in the manner in which it complied with or tried to comply with Clause 1 of the substitution provision. In our contract language argument, we say that the trial court erred in that ruling. And we say that because we believe that there is not a way to sustain the trial court's reading of the substitution provision in requiring that the value at grant be focused on in determining the value of the replacement Cabletron options. There's no way to sustain that reading of the provision on the plain language of the agreement. And we really say that for 2 core fundamental reasons. First of all, if, as the trial court found, the parties had intended the value of the replacement options to match the value of the original options as of the grant of those original options, that value, number one, was a known number at the time of the grant of the original options. And number two, it was a static number. That is to say, precisely because it was to match the value at grant, there would be a single dollar value at grant, and that number would not change over time. So if the parties were shooting for, in that provision, a number that was both known at the time of contracting and static throughout the performance under the provision, the parties would have included that number in the substitution provision itself, just like in Clause 2 of the substitution provision, they included a static number, $4.62 million, as the number that would have to be used if the cash choice under the substitution provision was chosen.
And what would the number in Clause Number 1 have been, and what would the year be if they would have put a number in?
Under our reading, the number would have, well, under our reading, there wouldn't have been a number because it would have changed over time. Under our reading, the dollar number was not static. It was changing over time as the value of the original GNCS options changed over time.
And this spoke to my question. What would the number have been if they would have put a number in for the options at the time?
Under the judge's ruling, the number would have been $5.016 million, because that's what the judge found we were required to do. The judge said, the trial judge said, the original GNCS options had an intrinsic value at the time of their grant of $5.016 million. And so Cabletron should have, in issuing the replacement Cabletron options, issued Cabletron options having, at the time of their issuance, also an intrinsic aggregate intrinsic value of $5.016 million.
So going back to your argument, if the Court of Chancery's ruling is correct, then it basically would have said your client can pay $5 million or $4.6 million, and your client would have always picked number two.
And that's why we contend that that isn't a reasonable reading of the provision, precisely for that reason. That is to say, if it's a static number and doesn't change over time, what the provision would have said, had it been written according to the way the Chancery Court ruled, what the provision would have said is you have a choice of number one, issuing replacement options having an aggregate intrinsic value of $5.016 million, or two, paying $4.62 million in cash for all of the options. And it would have made no sense, for the reason that Your Honor is suggesting, for the parties to have ever negotiated for that, because as you're suggesting, Clause 2 would always be chosen over Clause 1 because of the lower burden of Clause 2. That's our sort of the flip side of our argument as to why the Chancery Court's reading can't be squared with the language of the provision, because the only reason to have the two options, if there are some scenarios where Clause 1 is less burdensome and some scenarios where Clause 2 is less burdensome. And so what Cabletron obviously was bargaining for in having that choice was to be able to pick the less burdensome alternative. The only way in which you could have a situation where in some scenarios Clause 1 would be less burdensome and in some scenarios Clause 2 would be less burdensome would be if the value of the replacement options, that is the required value of the replacement options, would change over time. And the reason that would be because what you have to do with the replacement options is match the value of the original options at replacement, so that as the option value changes over time, that is, of the original options, the required value of the replacement options likewise changes over time. And that's the reason why, from the plain language of the agreement, the parties put a standard in of equivalence, so that it could change over time to reflect changes in the value of the original options. That was the whole rationale. One can see just from the plain language of the document why that standard was used instead of the fixed number that they would have used if they were trying to do what the trial court found they were trying to do in that provision. Also, a third reason why the provision really can't be read in that fashion, we believe, is that it defeats the whole purpose of the option. When you get an option, the purpose of getting an incentive stock option is to be able to hold the option and get the value that accrues in the option subsequent to its issuance. Under the trial court's ruling, what happened here, according to the trial court, is that when the circumstance arose and we had the choice of replacing the options, we got to go back to square one and strip away any value that would have accrued in the options, that is the original options, between the date of their grant and the date of the replacement a year later. It makes no sense at all to imagine that parties would bargain for a provision under which they would get incentive stock options, which presumably would accrue value during the entire period prior to this replacement occurring, and then allow and expect that all of that accrued value would be stripped away by having the options that were replacing the original options be keyed to the value the original options had at grant rather than at replacement. So for all those reasons, we believe that the trial court's reading of the language of the substitution provision just cannot be squared with that language, and for that reason alone, you don't even get into any of the other issues in the case, the plaintiffs could not sustain their burden of showing that we breached the agreement because they couldn't show that we had not done what we were supposed to do under the agreement when we, as is undisputed, issued options that matched the value of the original options at replacement.
Okay, I'm confused here. These options vested over time, right?
Yes.
And in fact, they hadn't fully vested by the time the trigger event happened, so the parties didn't, regardless of how they were valued, they were not getting the full number of options that they could have gotten if they'd gone the full 4 years, right?
None of them had vested, actually, right, as of the time of the replacement. And so, unless and until, let's say that we had issued the options the trial court said we should have issued, none of those options would have been vested as of that date. They would have vested, if ever, over time, depending on whether or not the conditions to vesting were achieved, which, as we know, they weren't achieved in regard to the majority of the options.
Okay. Well, I'm just curious, because wouldn't that explain the difference between option one and option two? That under option two, you get $4.62 million for all options then held by the partners. And it wouldn't matter whether they'd all vested or not. Whereas under the first one, you get equivalent replacement awards. That's not the difference between those two?
Well, it's a difference, but it doesn't explain, in my view, Your Honor, the reason why the parties would have structured it that way. You're right. Under one, there's immediate cash payment for all the options, and that cash payment is the same regardless of whether the options have vested in whole or in part or not at all. You're right. That's absolutely right. And under the other choice, clause one, you issue equivalent replacement options to the original options, and there you're matching where you were in terms of vesting and in terms of the other preconditions to the exercise of the option. So that's what really would be tried to be matched in terms of the equivalent.
How do you work in the schedule of a series of payouts to that formula, which are in the future?
It would be basically, how do I work it in, or how do the trial court work it in?
Both.
Okay. We would work it in by basically saying you issue options that match the value, that is the intrinsic value, whatever it was, positive, negative, or flat, of the original options as of the time of replacement, and the rest of the vesting schedule just stays as is. So they're basically put in the exact same position they were in as of the date of replacement, except they're holding a Cabletron piece of paper now instead of a GNTF piece of paper. But everything else in terms of the vesting schedule for the options, the fact that they'd be exercisable over a period of time, the fact that they would not expire for a certain number of years, all the other provisions would be the same, except it would now be an option on Cabletron stock rather than an option on GNTF stock, and there would be no difference in terms of whatever value had accrued or not in the original GNTF options in the meantime. So that you just, the concept is you just keep the parties right where they were, but they now have a Cabletron option. Cabletron was a public company instead of a GNTS option. GNTS was a subsidiary of Cabletron and not a public company. That was the whole reason for the substitution provision. It was triggered by a scenario where GNTS was not going to go public, so you instead put the holders of the GNTS options in a position where they now would have an option in a public company, namely then Cabletron, now Enterasys.
It's my understanding that the Court of Chancery's selection of this approach is one that wasn't argued by either side.
Correct. In fact, we argued for the argument I've articulated, which is we argued that you should match the value of the original options at replacement. That was our argument from day one to day, whatever it is. It's our argument today. The plaintiffs argued that the value of the replacement options had to match the clause 2 number, that is the $4.62 million. What the plaintiff said is, and the Chancery Court essentially rejected that argument, saying there's no way you can read the agreement to say that. What the plaintiff said was, we thought what should happen was that the intrinsic value of any replacement options should be $4.62 million. They said that in the interrogatory answers, all of this is cited in our brief. They said that in deposition. And the lead negotiator for the plaintiffs at trial under cross-examination, we said this in our brief, repeated that under oath, that that's what he thought the provision said. That really leads into the forthright negotiator issue, which is our second appellate issue, and why we feel the trial court, with respect, made a clear error of law in applying the forthright negotiator principle to resolve the ambiguity that the trial court found in the substitution provision. That is, the trial court found that you couldn't tell from the face of the agreement whether it was value at grant or value at replacement. The trial court rejected the proposition that it was $4.62 million of intrinsic value. But the trial court then, under the forthright negotiator principle, resolved the ambiguity in favor of the value at grant reading of the substitution provision. The problem with that is that the law under the forthright negotiator principle is very, very clear that not only does the interpretation have to be one that's objectively reasonable under the agreement itself, under the language of the agreement, but more, well, equally important, I should say, it has to be the interpretation that the party advancing the interpretation actually subjectively held at the time. That's black letter law from the forthright negotiator principle.
Can I interrupt? This is the first time that I saw this principle, the forthright negotiator principle. Is this something that's universally adopted around the country? I know that Chancellor Allen coined the term, or it appears that he coined the term, a few years ago. I'm not aware that that's a principle.
Well, fair enough. I don't think it's particularly controversial, but we didn't find any case from this court that embraced it. All I know is that when it has been embraced by several Chancery Court decisions, it's been articulated in the way that I articulated it. The key thing is that the proponent of the interpretation must have actually held that interpretation subjectively at the time the contract was negotiated, or else the principle has no applicability whatsoever. That's a key prong of the test for the application of the principle. Here, there was no finding at all in the Chancery Court's decision to the effect that the plaintiffs subjectively understood or thought they understood that the substitution provision would give them value at grant if it were ever to come into play. And there couldn't have been any such finding because there was no evidence to that effect, and there was no evidence to that effect because from start to finish in the case, the plaintiffs themselves stood on the witness stand under oath or signed interrogatories under oath that said, no, we had a completely different interpretation. Our interpretation was not value at grant. Our interpretation was $4.62 million of intrinsic value per clause 2. And in terms of value at grant, during cross-examination at trial, the plaintiff's lead negotiator testified that he understood that there was no guaranteed intrinsic value at grant in the original options. He understood that the agreement itself called for the original options to have a fair market value strike price at the time of issuance. He understood that as a result, any value that would accrue in the options would accrue subsequent to that date. So they cannot possibly have had the interpretation that they were getting value at grant in their placement options because they would have then felt they were getting no intrinsic value in their placement options, and they've been consistent in saying from start to finish that they were only going to get $4.62 million.
Mr. Moore, let me interrupt you. You have about 2.5 minutes
yes.
of your total time.
Right.
Would you like to continue now?
Why don't I adjourn and preserve my 2 minutes if I may? Thank you.
Mr. Proctor, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Vernon Proctor for the plaintiffs and interveners. I'd just like to set a quick context for the argument, which my friend has not referred to, but I think it's important in determining what the proper construction of the agreement is. This is an appeal and cross-appeal from the Court of Chancery after a full trial on the merits, where the trial court had the full opportunity to evaluate the credibility of all witnesses, including financial experts. And the factual context of this whole transaction was the sale of a business, that is, Bit Management, Inc., was sold to Cabletron in 2000 for a combination of cash and options. And Cabletron placed a value on this business, not my clients, but Cabletron did, a total of approximately $8.8 million in cash and options. And they weren't willing to give more than a certain amount of cash. So the remaining value had to be derived from the option component. And this whole transaction is executed, the sale of this business is executed in the context of an initial public offering for the GNTS subsidiary of Cabletron, which was understood by all parties to, at that time of contracting, to occur that fall. And that's a very critical point, which the trial court correctly noted in determining how to construe the agreement. In order to preserve the benefit of the bargain that the parties had negotiated, they carefully structured Exhibit 7.11. And there were two paragraphs which were, the first two paragraphs of the exhibit addressed the situation where there was an IPO. First paragraph, you have an express statement that there can be no vesting of the underlying stock until an IPO or spinoff occur. And the second paragraph is the what we call the gross-up provision, which is also in the context of an IPO, which specifically contemplates an actual value of these options in an IPO context, no matter what the strike price is. And so that is a value. That's one way of achieving that value. The other way of achieving the value was in what we call the substitution provision, which is the third paragraph of Exhibit 7.11. And that provides that in the event the IPO goes away due to a Cabletron decision, the parties, or Cabletron or the defendants, can satisfy their obligation in one of two ways, either equivalent, substitute, or replacement awards on the same terms and conditions, which must refer back to the IPO situation, or $4.62 million in cash. And when you ever have an agreement like this, which the court below found to be an alternative contract, the underlying concept is that the relative values of the alternatives have to be the same or very close to it. And the problem with the appellant's position is that by their value of replacement theory, in the context when IPO goes away, and the uncontradicted testimony at trial was that the value of the business would likely go down, exactly what happened is what the plaintiffs were trying to negotiate around. And that was, they lost the value of their opportunity, and they were compensated not for equivalent substitute replacement awards, not for something having a value of $4.62 million or close to it that they thought they'd negotiated, but they get hopelessly underwater options at the time of replacement. At the time of contracting, it's intuitively impossible to have, you have, do I want underwater options? Do I want $4.62 million? It just doesn't work. So the only way to construe the agreement properly as a whole is to equate, you have a value in the IPO portion of roughly $5 million, and you have equivalent substitute replacement awards if the IPO is pulled, which can only relate back to that. And then
Couldn't there have easily been a provision, but no less than $4.6 million?
There could have been, Your Honor. But with all due respect, I think that's letting the perfect be the enemy of the good. I mean, we believe that the way that the final agreement was structured, and they're the ones, my opponents are the ones who are saying you've got to read it plain, meaning it's not ambiguous, and they take that position to this day. But our view is there was no need for it because of the way the agreement was structured.
What's your response to Mr. Neal's argument that by going back to the original date, the Court of Chancery basically denied any increase in the value of the options over time, and that that could not have been contemplated?
I think the answer has to be you have to go back to what the expectations of the parties were at the time the deal was negotiated. That there would be an IPO that was imminently expected at $15, and the gross-up provision was structured to keep that total value constant as the strike price increased. You got closer to the IPO, the total numbers of options would increase. Under their view, if you take their value replacement theory as true, I mean, the total number of the options would have had to decrease to keep the intrinsic value at zero, which they've claimed from the beginning of the case, and that just doesn't make any sense. The whole point of the substitution, I'm sorry, the gross up was to have a $15 value for the IPO, and that's the way it works. That's what the parties anticipated.
Well, but it does relate to his argument about why there wasn't a number in choice number one and there was a number in choice number two. That what does the record reflect with regard to the party's expectation? Because as Justice Ridgely said, if your clients were basically going to be guaranteed 4.6, that wasn't clear. And if they weren't guaranteed 4.6 million, then Mr. Meehl's clients would have an opportunity to pay them less than 4.6 if that's the way circumstances played out.
That's not the way, with all due respect, that the structure of the agreement worked. The equivalence is measured backwards toward the IPO. That's the antecedent. And once you get to the post-IPO period, the choice is that you have to focus on that clause, the substitution provision that they can get alternatives which are supposed to be relatively equal. And the defendants have not ever really set forth a realistic scenario whereby the Clause 2 would ever be exercised, the 4.62 would ever be exercised, except in the rare circumstance post-IPO where somebody, a white knight, waded in and threw a lot of money on the table. And that was what the evidence was. I'd like to move forward briefly because I want to get to my cross-appeal point. That on the fourth-rate negotiator principle, first, I want to refer your honors back to the, want to encourage you to read the interrogatory answers they keep pounding on, because if you read those carefully, you'll find, first of all, that they consistently refer back to their expectations of receiving value equivalent to what was contemplated at the time of issuance. They all refer back to that original grant date. And they also are very clear that Enteris' securities were not the only possibility. In fact, we objected to their interrogatory 7 on that basis. So it could have been other options, including, hopefully, an IPO in another Enteris' sub, which at the time of contracting was a realistic possibility and was the reason why my clients did this deal. They entered into this agreement of sale of their business because they wanted to monetize these things, and that was the best way to do it. On the cross-appeal points, my client's position, Your Honors, is that the Court of Chancery erred in cutting off the recovery the way he did. We believe that that's true for a number of reasons. First of all, the court itself recognized what the loss was. There's a disagreement between the parties as to what the loss under the expectation principle is. The trial court was right in theory when it said that what was lost, and so this is pages 26 and 28 of the slip opinion, was the opportunity to get more value for these options. If it was going to be a security, they wanted to have an IPO-able security, if at all possible. And the question was how to get there. So then the court proceeded to look at what the picture was at the time of contracting, when you're supposed to have reasonably equivalent recoveries. But it took advantage, it decided to assume that the vesting and employment conditions would not be satisfied. And as of the time of contracting, there was really no basis for that assumption to be made. indeed, if you look at the circumstances, the defendants negotiated for a 4-year employment contract with the partner, the bid partners, to make sure they'd stick around. So there was no expectation at the time of contracting that there would be discharge or that the opportunity for vesting would be foregone. And what happened here was basically there are other issues as well. I mean, it was not a foreseeable result, which is a cardinal principle of contract damage calculations. And contrary to what my friends say, this was not a case where any kind of avoidable consequences would kick in. I mean, this is a situation where in April of 2002, after the trial court found that Enterasys had breached the agreement, Enterasys compounded its problems by when it was in material breach of this agreement by discharging my clients and therefore precluding them from ever having a chance to exercise these. And the trial court overlooked that principle as well. As we see it, it was a total breach and a repudiation by Enterasys of its obligations under Exhibit 7.11. And that's what we're focused on the appeal, that there was the other parts of the stock purchase agreement were essentially performed, and you had Exhibit 7.11 was what, by virtue of discharging my clients, they violated. So as we see it, whatever the arguments are about alternative contracts and such, which basically the trial court's ruling kind of undercut its own conclusion that there was an alternative contract, that is trumped by Enterasys' conduct in terms of a total breach of the stock purchase agreement from and after August of 2001. Finally, a brief point.
Let me interrupt to make sure I understand you. Are you saying that under this agreement, your clients simply could not be fired?
No. What we're saying was there were two separate agreements. The partners, Your Honor, had employment agreements.
Right.
The employees, other employees were employees at will. So far as I know, the bid partners' employment contracts were honored, notwithstanding their discharge. But what happened was when they terminated the agreement, they're purporting to take advantage of a unilateral right to terminate. But when a party is in material breach, that does not, you can't destroy otherwise existing contract rights by doing that. And that's what the Cirrus case says. And so for those and any number of the other reasons set forth in our briefs, we believe that the trial court was in error when it reduced the damages, the expectancy damages of $4.62 million. To less than half of that. Finally, there's one other point I wanted to go back to. The point that the other, I'm switching gears for a minute, I'm going back to the enforcement. The idea that the difference between $5.01 million and $4.62 million is somehow outcome determinative, it does not square with reason. That is, the record is clear that at the end of the day, on the day of closing or the day before closing, a few more employees were hired and some more options were added to the mix, and that raised the number up when you did the math under the gross up provision from slightly under 4.62 to 5.01. But that should in no way detract from the trial court's liability analysis, that they should, to be put in the same position, they should have received options that were worth what Dr. Gerald said they were worth, options that were to be valued as of the date of their grant in view of the context of the IPF. If you have any other questions, I'll just reserve my remaining time.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
To resume, first of all, we also had briefed two other significant and independently dispositive arguments relative to, number one, the valuation methodology that the trial court employed in terms of determining the value of the original GNTS options, and secondly, in terms of the measure of damages here. I don't want to slip over those arguments, but at the same time, I'm content to rely on our briefs on those arguments. We feel very strongly about them, unless any of Your Honors has questions about those particular arguments or sort of our damages arguments. Hearing no questions, we then circle back to a couple of the points that Mr. Proctor just made. First of all, I'd like to sort of try and put an end once and for all to the notion that is continually voiced in the briefs by the other side but never actually sustained on the evidence, and that is this notion that there was some sort of certainty or imminent or high likelihood of an IPO of GNTS at $15 per share, and that that somehow has a bearing on the proper interpretation of this contract. Reading from the deposition testimony, which was repeated at trial, of Mr. Comrie on this very topic. This is page 215 of Mr. Comrie's deposition. It's also a trial transcript, pages 155, 156.
And what page in the appendix?
Appendix page 418. In terms of the trial testimony, the deposition testimony isn't in the appendix, it is in the record, but it's page 215 of Mr. Comrie's deposition. Question, this is me. How significant of a possibility do you perceive it to be, that is, the possibility that the IPO would not be completed? 50-50. Question, you also perceive the possibility that the IPO, even if completed, would be completed at a price less than $15 per share, right? Answer, that was a possibility I had considered. Question, and that was a realistic possibility, correct? Answer, yes. That testimony was also repeated in basically the same language at trial by Mr. Comrie. The point being that everyone knew there was a significant risk that the IPO would never happen. Everyone knew there was a significant risk that even if the IPO did happen, it would happen at a price of less than $15 per share. That was a risk that the plaintiffs took in agreeing to take the original GNTS options, and therefore that was a risk that the plaintiffs likewise took in agreeing that the original GNTS options could be replaced by equivalent Cabletron options. All we're asking to do, have the clerk do, is enforce the agreement in accordance with the risks that the parties clearly allocated between themselves in that fashion. Thank you very much.
Your Honor, just one point on the 50-50 testimony. It's also two points on that. First of all, the Vice Chancellor heard and evaluated that testimony in determining who was more credible in terms of whether it was time of replacement or time of issuance. He obviously weighed the credibility of the witnesses in the plaintiff's favor on a total basis. More specifically, Your Honors, the testimony is also clear, and this is, you can read Mr. Knoll's testimony, their chief negotiator, and Mr. Comrie's, that at the time of contracting, $15 was the expected price, and nobody had ever told Mr. Comrie or anybody else anything different. If you have 50-50, and that's all that really suggests to me is that they wanted to protect themselves. But what they were told by the defendants who wanted to buy this company was, this was something that was going to happen. It was going to happen this fall, and the price is going to be $15. So, Your Honor, when you're thinking about issues of credibility and such, please bear that in mind. Unless Your Honors have any more questions of me, I am finished.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments. And the court will take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn.
Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything before the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware may now depart and give their attendance to the call of the court. The court is now adjourned. God save the state.